Thursday evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Look for us everywhere in social media. You know where to find us. We're everywhere. I want to introduce my special guest host for this evening's broadcast, Ro Cusan, from calling in from New Orleans. Ro, welcome to the show. How are you this evening?
Great, Pam. How you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. I'm very excited about tonight. We have, to me, a living legend, a literary legend with us tonight. Of his recent book, Publishers Weekly said this, "Stunning. Crisp dialogue highlights this tale of redemption and the bonds of family, and the breathtaking conclusion is one that readers won't soon forget." By booklist, they said, Burke wins us over once again with another fuselage of lyrical, deeply moving prose that makes us feel the beating hearts of all his characters, demon-racked though they may be. It is my honor and my privilege to welcome to Authors on the Air the master, James Lee Burke. Jim, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's very kind of you.
I am so honored that you're here, sir. Ro and I have been talking about this moment for a long time, and I'm delighted that you're here. I want to say congratulations on your new book, The House of the Rising Sun. Boy, this is an epic tale, is it not, Jim?
Well, I think the word is justified. Yes, it is an epic story, and it deals with the closing of the American frontier and the entry of America into the 20th century as a world power, and the arms industry, and it begins in 1916 down in Mexico with John Pershing's punitive expedition into Mexico when, the United States was chasing Pancho Villa around. But it's a mythic story, though, as well. It deals with the search for the Holy Grail in modern times.
Jim, you have so many stunning stories, and your characters are so vivid and so alive. Every book that I've read of yours, regardless of which series it is, series characters, or whether it's a standalone, paints just a gorgeous picture. It feels so real with your prose. But it occurs to me on this book, because of the nature of the span of time, that you must have done quite a bit of research. Is that true?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that, but I don't do much research. And in fact,
goodness.
I do hardly any. It probably shows.
No! Really? So you are a history buff then, because you have so many facts committed to memory, or are you just overlaying your characters, I guess, in what you already know to be true?
It's the latter. That's correct.
Is it really?
Yes.
You're my guest, and I want you to tell me about this book and where this story came from. I have to tell you, my favorite book that you wrote so far has been Bitterroot, and I know where that story came from, but I don't know where this one comes from.
Well, many of the characters are historical ones. They're biographical, and the Holland family, about whom I write, is based on my mother's family. My grandmother was Allifair Holland. My daughter's name is Allifair. She's named for her grandmother. But my family was born, my parents were born either in the last century or my uncles and aunts were all people born at the end of the Victorian age. But the Hollands were pioneer people. They were oftentimes, sometimes they were known for their violence. I'm sorry. My great-grandfather was Sam Morgan Holland. He was a legendary drover. He was in the war between the states, and during Reconstruction, he trailed cows up the Chisholm to Wichita and Abilene. But he was a violent and drunken man, a very dangerous person. He killed at least 9 men, and there were others he never talked about. But he became later on a saddle preacher. It's really an interesting story about this violent man's conversion to Christianity. And he preached from the saddle the rest of his life on the old Chisholm Trail. But his descendants are still with us, and I'm one of them, although I don't shoot people.
No, I would imagine,
but
you don't.
I do write about him often and his family, but the stories, you see, are meant to be emblematic. The story is set in the past from the year 1891 to the year 1919, the year of the great influenza epidemic. It's set in Old Mexico and Texas, and the story also goes to the Battle of the Marne, you know, one of the worst engagements of the First World War. And I made use of the story of Abraham and his lost son Ishmael, and that's the center of the story. Hackberry Holland, the former Texas Ranger, is trying to find his son Ishmael, who is a captain in the U.S. Army and the commander of Negro troops. That's how they were referred to during that period. And the story goes to France in the year 1918. But it's without a doubt my best work. It's far beyond anything else I've written. But it deals with not historical times. The story is about today. T.E. Lawrence, in his great book, his seminal book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, said in 1915, the issue is oil. The issue is oil that's under the sands of the Sahara, the great Mideastern bowl. And the issue is still the same. Nothing has changed in 100 years. And
amazing.
That 100 years is marked by the rebirth of neocolonialism. And the book has that story as its backdrop.
I am fascinated by the women characters you have created. I don't want to say you created an homage to strong women, but essentially you have. You have three diverse characters here with totally different backgrounds, but each of them has their own strengths. And they aid him in his search for this grail and to return it to its rightful place. I know that you like writing strong women in your books, but how did you come about finding these three? There was Ruby the Danish woman, and that was the one that is Ishmael's mother, correct?
Correct.
And then you have...
She's a great character. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes, her name is Ruby Pardon me, go ahead.
Danson. I'm sorry, you say it. You know the story better than I do, my goodness.
Her name
about
is
this.
Ruby Danson is the lady's name, and she's an organizer for the IWW, the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World. And she was at the massacre at Ludlow, Colorado in 1914, and that was when the IWW and the United Mine Workers of the World tried to organize. It was also the year that John Rockefeller's goons murdered many miners. I've been down in that storm cellar at Lolo. It's right off of Highway 25. It's on this flat piece of hard pan land that runs right into the Rocky Mountains. It's windswept and desolate. But they had climbed down into a cellar underneath a tent, and the Colorado State Militia and Rockefeller's goons used machine guns on the striking miners, and they set fire to the tents, and they smothered or suffocated, I think it was 11 or 13 women and children down in that cellar. And I went down in there, my wife and I did once, and it's a haunting feeling. You can feel it. You can feel the presence of those people in there still today. That's how Rockefeller began his career as a philanthropist. He had to change his image, and it worked. He was the most hated man in America at that time. but he had some pretty slick ad guys working for him.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with Barry Eisler last night, who sends his best regards to you. We talked about spin and changing the face of something to make it look acceptable. So it was a really fascinating conversation. And here again, you're mentioning the same thing. You know, he had an image makeover, so I'm fascinated by that as well. You also have another character named Beatrice de Molay, who is a madam. And she has a very interesting backstory also. Would you share that, please, with our listeners?
Yes, we meet this madam of a brothel down in Mexico, but before she managed this brothel into which Hackberry Holland wanders after he's escaped from imprisonment by Pancho Villa's army, Beatrice de Molay ran the House of the Rising Sun in New Orleans, and that's the legendary story that became the famous song that the animals, the animals recorded.
Yeah,
Eric Burden and the Animals, yes.
Pardon?
Yes, that's correct, Eric Burden and the Animals.
Right. But anyway, Beatrice de Molay is a direct descendant of Jacques de Molay, the Templar knight, or Knight Templar, who was burned to death at the stake in front of St. Louis Cathedral in Paris in the 14th century. And it was he who brought back the Shroud of Turin from the Holy Land. But it was also rumored that he brought back the Grail. And that's the story I use. Beatrice de Molay knows where the Grail is. And here she is, the manager of a brothel, who is protecting the cup that Jesus drank from. But a bad guy gets his hands on it.
You have one other female character that I'd like you to tell us about. Her name, I love it. You say she's like the a rival to Lady Macbeth. Her name is Maggie Bassett. So it was, I had a clear picture of her immediately when you gave that description before I started reading. So tell us about Maggie Bassett.
Maggie Bassett is an intriguing character and one of the most complex I've written about. And she was the lover of the Sundance Kid, whose real name was Harry Longabout. And she maintains in the book that both Harry and Butch Cassidy were not killed in Bolivia, that they came back to the United States. That is probably true of Butch. Whether or not Harry Longabout made it back is up for grabs. But Maggie Bassett in the story is an educated woman who was forced into prostitution. Educated in that she was a school teacher and went to boarding schools and had an education far beyond most women on the frontier during that period. But Maggie was forced into prostitution when she was 19 years old in San Antonio. And she swore early on that she was not only going to get even, but she was going to get rich. And when Maggie gets even...
Oh, boy.
Maggie really does. But
she does.
I think Lady Macbeth would have to maybe...
Step aside, don't you think? She's met her match, don't you?
She met her match at the
bed. Absolutely. I love the fact that those women are an integral part of this story, although not the only part. They're, obviously the search for Ishmael and the recovery of the Grail is very, very key to this. Ro, I know that you read the book. Do you have some questions you want to ask?
I was just about to talk about Ruby, that the chapter where Hack meets Ruby and they decide to go on the date. Like I was grinning the whole time I read that. It's a short chapter, but it's just perfection. It's just like it's so wonderful. I was like, it had been maybe a couple of years since I read one of Jim's book, and I was really into the story, but when that particular chapter hit, I was like, I got to read that book very slowly. I don't want to get to the end of it too fast. It's just just perfection. I loved it.
Well, thank
Jim,
you very much.
When people talk to you about reading your books, do you often hear, because this was, Ro and I have talked about this, as have other people, your books are not books to be read quickly. I'm a pretty fast reader myself, but I will admit that your prose is so exquisite to read that I actually read it out loud because I love the sound of the words, the way you've constructed your sentences and so on. Do people often tell you that they read your work very slowly?
Well, many people do. It's very flattering because, of course, as you well know, that a lot of novels are written today to be read in a hurry, and they tend to sell pretty well, often to people who commute to work. I'm not criticizing them, but my work is probably much more traditional and requires a person more time to read it, but I'm happy that people do.
To me, it's like a good meal. You know, it's like tasting like amazing food. You just have to savor it. It's like little tiny bites by tiny bites, and you really don't want to rush that stuff. And that's
well, thank you.
This is like.
I mentioned to you before we started the show that I wanted to ask you about the interesting jobs that you've had, and you laughed. You said, "Oh, yeah, I've done a lot of things," and you kind of made a joke of it. But the fact of the matter is, you've done a lot of interesting things, Jim. Can you share some of those things with us, please?
Well, I have had numerous jobs over the years, and I make a joke about them. But I was born in the Depression, and as such, I probably belong to the last group of people who will remember what we call traditional America. And I said this once to a reporter from the Wall Street Journal, and he said, he was a nice guy, but he said, "Oh, well, you know, every generation feels that way." And I didn't say anything, but he was not correct in his perception. The United States in which we live today is not the United States in which I grew up, and every one of my generation knows that. Arthur Miller once said this, that unless a person understands the Great Depression, he cannot understand contemporary America. Someone else said something very similar, but in a different vein. It was F. Scott Fitzgerald. He said, "You cannot understand the United States unless you understand the graves of Shiloh." What a line.
Wow.
23,000 died in those 3 days. It shocked the entire world. No one thought this new republic would suddenly find itself in a war where literally people who had the same religion, who had the same vocations, whose homes were only a few miles apart along the border, would slay each other to such a degree that the world had never seen bloodshed, at least in war, with that intensity. And, of course, it was the first time that modern weaponry was used in a war that made use of classical continental infantry tactics. But the point is that this is still a working class nation, and we forget that. And the other thing we forget is that we're the children of Puritans. Those guys who hanged their neighbors in 1692 are still with us. And the mindset, the fundamentalism, and they had many virtues, but the fundamentalistic certainty with which they operated is still with us today. And I found as a young man, I was very fortunate, I worked a little bit in the oil field and on the pipeline, that I met people who probably in some ways had that same frontier spirit. They were people, the bravest people I ever knew were in the oil field, because a lot of it is very dangerous. If you start to daydream You get hit by a chain or the tongs on a drilling rig, or if you're building dynamite charges that go down the pipe on a seismograph rig, you can drop a primer or dynamite cap and just blow the whole barge out of the water. But these people work for almost nothing. And we used to work 10 hours days, and it'd be 100 degrees by noon. Everything you touch would burn your hand, you know, the deck. The gunwales were just literally on fire. I never heard one of these guys complain. They never complained about the food, the low pay, the hard hours. They were thankful they had the work, and they were absolutely fearless. That's what I couldn't ever get over. They had, if they had any fear, they never showed it. And these same men had soldiered all over the world. They'd gone through the Depression, and then they'd been in the Pacific and European theaters during the war. So I used to look around me at these men, most of whom, they didn't have last names. They only had initials, JWWJ. Those were the two most common, but they didn't give.
I love that story you told. I read the article where you were telling that story, and I thought that was pretty interesting, because in the same time you were asked, did you consider yourself a liberal? And you said, I consider myself pretty traditional. And I thought that was really a wonderful thing to say, because, you know, I understand that my parents were, my parents are gone now, but they were of that age as well. And, you know, that era, they grew up, were born in the early 1920s. So I understand what you're saying. It's really interesting. When you talk about the pipeliners, you said that that was, you thought that was one of the most interesting group of people that you had ever met.
Oh, yeah. And gypsies. Pardon, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're the guest. You talk.
Well,
please.
These guys are like legionnaires, like Roman legionnaires. They're on the cutting edge of the new American empire. And they've been absolutely everywhere. Saudi Arabia, Greenland, Iceland, Venezuela. Any place there's oil and natural gas, that's where they end up. But what used to kill me about that, I knew what one of these guys... name was W.J. I was probably telling the story about the time W.J. got refused service in a nightclub outside of Lake Charles.
Yes. Anyway, that's what you're talking
about. W.J. had been in the Army 7 years. He was both in Europe and in the Pacific. I think when he was discharged, he even had his one private, his PFC stripe.
That's what you said. He was had the same thing. He's gone for 7 years. He never went any further than that. But he did his job. He did what he had to do, right?
Well, wait a minute. But here's the rest of the story on WJ.
Charles. Yeah.
You see, okay, it's at a nightclub outside of Lake Charles, Louisiana. WJ's causing trouble. The bouncers threw him out. So he went back, tried to get back in, and they locked the door on him. Big mistake. W.J. got in the welding truck and backed it off about 50 feet and plowed right through the front wall.
Oh, my God.
Out onto the dance floor, blowing his horn for a drink.
Oh, my gosh.
The bouncers almost killed him. About 3 weeks late, he was in jail in Lake Charles about 3 weeks. And then he came back to the drilling rig. Someone, the party chief said, where the hell you been, WJ? And he said, Lake Charles, Louisiana. I ain't ever going back there again. Those people are a bunch of damn liars. He said, I backed up my truck and drove it through the front of the building and out the back wall. He said, I don't have no such memory at all. If I had done something that bad, I would remember it. So I ain't never going back to Lake Charles. The problem was Lake Charles.
What a great story. What a great story. Those stories like that has to be fodder for great characters in your books, too, I would imagine.
They're the greatest. They are the best.
Oh, my Lord. You, that's a good story. I was reading an article that was written, you were being interviewed, and you mentioned that. You also talk about alcoholism, and you said something really interesting. I actually posted it on my Facebook page because I found it so fascinating that you said this. You said, for people who've gotten on the dirty boogie, there are choices to be made. A man can stay on it and flame out, blow out his doors, crash and burn. That's when he can make a choice for another kind of life. Until a person gets to that point where he decides that he wants a better life, in all probability, he's going to live inside what is kind of hermetically sealed environment where insanity seems rational. It's an amazing bit of writing on your behalf.
Well, that's from one of the Dave Robichaux novels, correct?
Oh, well, you said this on you were being interviewed, I will tell you exactly the article, by it was the man behind Dave Robichaux, that's right, the Robichaux.
Yeah.
You were being interviewed by Reese Fuller. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, sure. He's from Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yes.
Yeah, Reese, sure.
Yes.
Yeah, but anyway, that's, of course, a theme in the Dave Robichaux novels. There are 20 of them, and Dave is a recovering alcoholic who's had slips. But the theme of the books, the Dave Robichaux books, really is it has less to do with alcoholism than it does with the story of Golgotha. It's actually the passion play. It begins with a trilogy, and the series ends with the trilogy. But it was my attempt at replicating Milton's Paradise Lost. I don't compare myself with John Milton, but the descent into the abyss and eventually discovering that there's another way to live. But it doesn't simply apply to people who are afflicted by addiction. It's on many levels.
Yes.
If I may, I'm just curious what when you quit drinking, what effect what happened with your writing, your creativity? Was that what effect did not drinking had on that?
Well, I didn't say that I quit drinking. I didn't say that I ever started drinking, but in answer to your question, Neruda was commenting on alcohol and the artist, and he said something that I thought was quite accurate and a cautionary word. He said that alcohol might seem to liberate the mind of the artist, and it for a while will seem to give a kind of lucidity to his perception that he had not been able to achieve without it. But he quickly learns that the effect is illusory, and alcohol will first take his art from him, then it will take his talent, then it will take his soul, and then it will take his life if he lends himself to it. Because every artist knows this, that he mortgages tomorrow for today. That there are a lot of things you can do well if you're tired or if your head's fragmented, you can soldier on through it, but creativity dies with loss of a lot of brain cells. But that's not meant to be an indictment of people who drink, but it's Hemingway used to say that, how did he put it, all matadors, all riders, all soldiers have the same kinds of addictions, and none of them are good, and none of them make their lives any better. But anyway.
Wow. Interesting. Now, Jim, you were a social worker for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a caseworker in Los Angeles many years ago, and this was the biggest education I had beyond academic study as a student in college. was in the slums of Los Angeles. It's quite an experience. And that's when I discovered the work of Michael Harrington. You remember the book, The Other America?
Yes.
He was quite a guy. He was with the Catholic Worker Movement, but he wrote that great book about the underside of America. But if you live in a slum, you quickly discover how slum economics work. For example, we lived in South Los Angeles. It was bad territory. It was a violent, dangerous place filled with desperate people, and where daily you saw bad things: people knocked through windows, and cops rousting people arbitrarily. We didn't use the term gangbangers back then, but street gangsters that were fighting over turf in order to control the drug and arms trade. But you quickly learn about the money that can be made in a slum, and it can be made legally. And I used to make out rent budgets all the time to absentee slumlords who lived in the Wilshire District and Beverly Hills or the Hollywood Hills. And the best tenant any slumlord can have is a welfare recipient, because the check is sent by the state of California, the rent check, and arrives the fourth day of the month, is deposited in the bank, and you never have to worry about the tenant. You just worry about the state of California getting the rent money to the landlord. The property taxes are low, and there's no maintenance because slumlords never fix anything. And then if the building really gets to be a problem, they hire a torch to burn it for the insurance money. But it works on every level in the slum. It's a Darwinian and predatory environment. And, for example, during the Watts riot, the town really got trashed, and then later there was a repeat with the Rodney King riots. Every building would get torched in the riot area except the bail bonds office and the funeral home. Those were the only two buildings that were safe. Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Because he said it goes back to a Southern tradition. In every black rural ghetto in the South when I was growing up, the burial insurance collector went to the cabins and knocked on the doors at least one day a month, if not a week, to collect the money for burial insurance. Because for people of color back then, life was so wretched, and it was years ago. We really have a kind of self-inculcated state of amnesia about what it was to be black 50, 60, 70 years ago. But it was the next world they were looking forward to. And, of course, the bail bondsman is the guy that gets you out of the clink.
The guy you
don't want to lose.
You don't want to lose that connection at all.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
You were a newspaper reporter, too. Did you enjoy being a reporter?
I was at a talk once, when I was in graduate school at the University of Missouri, and Nelson Algren was our guest, and someone asked him that question. And I thought, well, he'd say, yeah, he learned a lot on a newspaper. He said, no, for one reason only. He said, yes, you learn how a city works. You learn the discrepancy between the reality of life in a city and how it's reported. Because the news in the newspaper is not the news. Every reporter knows the real news. For example, if you're a police reporter or you have been one and you read a story that is written in the passive voice, the subject was subdued. The action is passed from the object to the subject, the subject of the sentence. You follow me? But that is a sentence that was written to disguise what happened. That means somebody got thrown down a stairwell or hit in the upside the head or slapped around in the basement of the police station. But and every police reporter knows this. But secondly, on a newspaper, you don't learn to write there. What you learn to do is to put a story in such a way that it's acceptable in a family newspaper. But that often means keeping a blind eye. And there's hardly a newspaper in this country that doesn't have conservative influences working on it. I know for years and years we've heard this term, the liberal media. I mean,
yes.
The liberal media? 90% of American newspapers are owned by Republicans. Say it again, 90%.
Right.
Corporations like the networks are owned by guys.
I remember, if I can jump in, I remember...
Do business with baseball bats.
Right.
It's like calling Hollywood liberal. There are people in Hollywood, there's one very large entertainment company that was violating the minimum wage laws in Haiti, and which require that people be paid at least $4 a day. They were, and I won't name the company. These are not liberals. Libertine, perhaps.
Right, right.
But to call these guys liberal is hilarious.
Because this is a money-making, big money-making ventures, right, Jim? These were,
pardon?
This is all about making money. However they could, correct?
Well, what do you mean, the movies? I didn't quite follow you.
You're saying they're not liberal because of the people who own them, and so they really didn't. I want to make sure I'm clear on why you're saying that, because
there's such big
money ventures, correct?
No. What I'm saying is the term liberal media is now used as a given. There is no such thing as liberal media. Everybody who works in media knows this. The truth is all reporters, all journalists have one agenda, and that is to file the story and go to lunch or have a drink, you know, in the evening, you know, hang out with the guys or go home with their families. Nobody could care less what was in the story. There's no conspiracy at work. It's like the same people say America's universities are filled with liberals. Well, what does that say?
Yeah.
You mean the most intelligent people in the country are liberals, and that's bad? What does it say about the person who is denigrating them?
Well, there you go. That's true.
Look, the same guys, and this is, look, liberals have their problems too. But the fact,
sure.
Look at it this way. When you see the people who have their way, the people who constantly denigrate what they consider communist plots like consumer protection and social security and, you know, decent drinking water, you know, good schools, you know, all these Marxist concepts. When they have their own way, when they build the kind of society they like, what kind of place is it?
It's the lowest common denominator.
And when
sure.
they go on their vacations, they go to Malibu and San Fran and New York. They don't go. They don't go to some rat hole.
Right, right.
In the southwestern desert. They go to the places they supposedly despise.
Oh, you know what? That's right. You're right about that. I never considered it. Interesting.
Look, when you see a town where the only occupation is working in a roach paste factory and the social center is the DQ, you often find certain types of people. And they do really hate things like books.
Oh, well, yeah.
People,
that's true.
And people who don't appreciate, they're dumping the roach-based waste in our rivers and streams.
Yeah, that's true.
Look, my father used to say, it doesn't matter what your political perspective is. When you get three people walking in lockstep, you've got a problem.
Well, there you go. Yes.
If everybody agrees on it, it's wrong. But
yeah,
anyway,
no, I understand what you're saying.
We live in a time now of ideal, you know, unfortunately, it. I think the real issue is, I'm laughing about it. I hope I didn't offend anyone. I mean,
No.
I have no political or moral authority in these matters. But the real issue of our times, there are only two. One is the fact that we've taken on a role of our neocolonial antecedents, the British and the French. We're walking in their footsteps in the same sands that T.E. Lawrence walked in. And my own feeling is the consequence for us will be no different than it was for our antecedents. The social issue of our time is pluralism. That's the real issue. It's been there since the 60s. And there are a group of people in this country. They are the descendants of the Vigilantes, the Know-Nothing Party, the nativist movement of the 1830s and 40s, the isolationists, the American First Committee, and later the McCarthyites. They're very predictable. And the Jeffersonian dream of an egalitarian society is about to be realized, and they cannot abide it. It's intolerable to them. They will find every reason in the world to wage war against the kind of society that I think our founders would approve of, one in which women, people of color, gay people, immigrants, it doesn't matter, the kind of nation that this was intended to be. Jefferson, you know, tried to impose an abolitionist agenda upon the federal government, and in the year 1790, he formally gave it up because he knew it was impossible. And he made that famous statement. He said, "I fear for my country when I know that God is just." What a wonderful line. But that's it. We're right on the cusp of that egalitarian society.
I think you're right. I'm here. I want to take a little break here to remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking with the magnificent James Lee Burke. My guest host, Roxanne, is going to go ahead and take over for a little bit, but I want to give you the telephone number to call in and say hi to Jim Burke. The number is 347-633-9609. And I think Rose wants to talk to you about writing, so I'm going to turn the microphone over to him right now. Ro, it's all yours.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm still here. Giving my big mouth a break and letting Rose speak out.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
sir.
Can.
Hello? You can? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's see. I wanted to talk to you because I moved to New Orleans in 2005. I actually came here. I got to town 3 months before Katrina. And before this interview, I reread some part of the Tin Roof Blowdown, and it really took me back to those first post Katrina days in a visceral way. And I was just curious about what was your experience of that. Where were you when the storm hit, and did you come back to the city afterwards, or to Southeast Louisiana? I wanted to have your take on that.
We had a home on Bahia Teche in New Iberia, which is 2 hours, as you know, west of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
But when the hurricane hit, we were back in Montana.
Okay.
You dodged a bullet
time,
on
we,
that.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Hello?
At the time, you were in Montana at that time, though, then.
Correct. I've been in other hurricanes. I was on the water on a drill rig when Hurricane Audrey hit in 57. It went through Cameron, right south of Lake Charles. And
right.
Hurricane Hilda was one that was it wasn't, of course, on a level with Hurricane Katrina. But as I'm sure you both know, and much more so perhaps than I, if you were living in New Orleans at the time, that it wasn't the hurricane, it was the levees that destroyed the city.
Yeah. Did you ever came back, like, because, you know, all the your descriptions and everything, the smells and all that is really red, as if you had been there, like, shortly after the storm. Do you ever come back to Louisiana anymore?
Well, we sold our house a few years ago, but no, I was back in Louisiana after the storm. To give you an idea of, we see New Iberia and the Lafayette area and the Lake Charles area, you see, were hit by a second hurricane immediately after Katrina. A lot of people are not aware of that. And as I mentioned, in 57, I saw the effects of Katrina, which were very sad. And Hurricane Audrey. And you see without getting into a lot of macabre detail, there were many bodies in the swamps around the Calcasieu Basin, you know, outside of Lake Charles. But I was on a quarter boat after the hurricane passed, Audrey passed, and the islands in the Atchafalaya Basin, you know, it's a huge, I guess it's second in size only to the Everglades. It's a huge watershed, and it's covered with beautiful trees of every kind.
Yeah.
But the only thing you could see was water in the tops of the trees extending from the water. They looked like clumps of carrots, but the tops of the trees were filled with animals. It was really sad, and they were starving. They drowned, and they starved. And a lot of them were wood rabbits, and the raccoons would climb up the mooring ropes on our quarter boat, and cooks would feed them out of the galley. They'd put bacon grease and scraps out for these starving animals. When we went back to New Iberia after the two storms had passed, my wife and I tried to drive from New Iberia to Abbeville, and then we drove into an environment that is nothing like I had ever seen before or ever seen afterwards. The road was impassable because a kind of sludge that was made up of mud from the cane fields, dead animals, offal, and I don't know, maybe powdered construction material had covered the road, and it was a white, pasty color, but it had hardened. It looked like enormous tentacles that were the size of oak trees that had wrapped themselves around the road itself. But as far as we could see, we were standing on the two-lane road, my wife and I, looking directly south. From a 180-degree view, there was not a living thing as far as the eye could see. All
my
the
God.
Homes had been marked. They'd been marked with a code, spray painted. I think probably no bodies inside. That's what the spray paint was indicating. Cows had drowned inside the second stories of the farmhouses. They'd gotten that high, and then the water had gone over their heads. There was not one bird as far as the eye could see. This, of course, was in September. It was in the fall. I don't remember which month. Anyway, there was not a leaf on a tree as far as you could see. I never saw anything like it. It was like a scene out of a science fiction movie depicting a post-nuclear war. I never saw any natural setting that reminded me more of mortality and the ephemerality of the of perhaps the human race, just how it could be effaced from the earth.
I
never got it out of my head.
Yeah, I went to Andrew, and it, you know, was bad enough, but it wasn't nearly as bad as Katrina, and the resulting, that was just a society out of control, what was left of it, because it was just so devastating. It's very, very sad. Bro, did you have another question for Jim?
Yes. Three of your novels have been turned into movies, one of them by a French director, Bertrand Tavernier. I'm curious to know if you've seen any of them and what you thought about the experience.
Well, I worked a bit on a couple of them, and I worked with Bertrand Tavernier, and it was a great experience, and he is a grand gentleman. He's just one of the most interesting people I have ever known, and we have become good friends with him. He's visited our ranch a couple of times here in Montana, and he stayed with us in Louisiana. And he's just a grand gentleman, and he knows everybody in the movie industry. Not only knows, he knew everybody, people who have long since passed away. He was friends with John Ford and John Wayne and the great Italian directors, and he can just tell one wonderful story after another, and he never says an unkind word about anyone. Everybody loves Bertrand. He was given, when he was in New Iberia on location, he was given by the mayor the honorary title, the mayor of, the admiral of Bayou Teche.
Wow.
When
great.
He was staying at our house, Bertrand doesn't drive a car, and he's a big man. And if I'd go looking for him, sometimes I couldn't find him. And then I realized, just follow the crumbs. Bertrand eats five meals a day, and he'll walk around. He'll have a big piece of cake on a napkin in his palm, and he's eating while he talks. And he walks around and talks and eats all day. I've never seen a man with that much energy. And even the Mary Stenbergen, the actress, said that at 10 a.m. the whole crew had to do the Bertrand Tavernier forced march to this restaurant that sold boudin. He would start stuffing it down, 2 hours after breakfast.
Oh my lord! That's funny.
He would tell great stories about John Wayne. Just wonder. I mean, really good stories.
Wow, that is great. I have a question for you. I want to ask you about this. Must be a record, and I for everyone who is writing a novel and is trying to get published, I want to share with you a story of the Lost Get Back Boogie. Because if you've never read it, you're in for a treat. But first of all, tell us that story, Jim, about the Lost Get Back Boogie. It's a great story.
I published three novels in New York. And my first novel, I'd finished writing it when I was 23. And it came out with Houghton Mifflin. And I got a 6-column banner review in the New York Times Book Review, the Sunday Times Book Review. It was one of the best reviews I ever received. Bort Williams, a fine writer and a really fine Southern gentleman, wrote that review. And then I published one about the Kentucky coal mines to the Bright and Shining Sun. And my third one was called Lay Down My Sword and Shield, the first novel about the Hackberry Holland family and the Korean War. But I thought I was on board, and then I wrote the Lost Get Back Boogie, and it was rejected by about 10 houses, and the agency I had returned it to me and returned my other work as well. And I was back in the deep freeze, and Philip Spitzer, my agent, new agent who I got through my cousin Andre Dubuse, Philip Spitzer submitted the manuscript to 111 editors over a 9-year period, and it was thoroughly rejected. Not only rejected, it was vandalized. It was stabbed with ballpoint pens. There were glass rings in the margins. One guy wrote me a furious letter. It made people mad. And finally, my wife said, send it to LSU Press. She'd been saying that for some time. And LSU Press, Louisiana State University Press, published both the collection of my stories under the title The Convict and my thoroughly rejected novel, The Lost Get Back Boogie, and it was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize.
How about that? Is that not a story to behold?
Yeah.
I love that story.
No, that's a legend.
That story.
It's considered a record. 111 rejections. That's right.
It is a priceless, it is a story of resilience and don't give up because you never know what's going to happen. I love that story more than life itself. Ro, do you have any more questions for our guest? Because I know we've been keeping him because he's so wonderful. I never want you to leave, Jim. I want you to stay here. Sure, go ahead, Ro.
Can I interject something?
Sure,
can I interject something? Because otherwise he'll bother me all night. I'll be calling up the pastor at my church or my psychiatrist going to clinical depression. I didn't mean to offend. Most of the people I vote for never get elected. My vote is the kiss of death. And as I say, I have no authority in these matters. I'm a progressive, I guess. I believe in collective bargaining. I believe in a United States Constitution. I love this country. This is the greatest country on earth.
You
and
don't
the
have
reason
to make
it's
apology,
a great. No, no,
sure.
let me just
but
say
I'll let
it, okay?
You say it. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
The point is, you see, that divisiveness was encouraged by the founding fathers. They did not want a system that worked well. They wanted one that worked deliberately and slowly. Because they have feared that what happened in the French Revolution, with the French Republic, would happen here, the French General Assembly under Robespierre. That's why they wanted a government that could not be run by one branch or the other, that one would check and balance the other. And so when I say these things, I'm laughing at people who hang out at the Dairy Queen. These are the only places we live. We go to places that nobody else has found yet, and then these are the best places on earth, and then we spread rumors that the water is poison, there are neo-Nazis all over the place. The people are hateful, but it doesn't work for very long. Here comes another onslaught
of people
who flee, who replicate the society they just
They're trying to leave.
But that's the
right.
way it is.
That is the way
I
it is. No, this is your time. You get to run on and say whatever you wish.
Okay.
Ro, you have another question?
There was still on the movie point. I didn't. There was one last thing. I read that there was one of your short stories because I've seen the three movies, the three adaptation from your novels, but I read there was a short story that had been made into a short by, I think, it's some young director or something,
yeah.
And I couldn't find it anywhere. I was wondering if you could tell me about it.
Yes. Well, I'm really happy you asked that. Julian Higgins is the director. He's a very talented young guy, a guy that's going to have a career like Steven Spielberg or some of the other great directors. But he adapted Winter Light, a short story that I wrote, and it's really a beautiful short action film. It made the top 10 in the nominations, but it didn't make the top 5, unfortunately. But Julian is a great talent. I was really honored that he adapted my work.
How
did he approach you about getting getting the the short movie made? Did he
sir? Hello?
Hello?
Say it again.
Yes.
Say it again, Ro. Repeat
Hello?
What you said, Ro. Ro. Okay, he dropped. I'm sorry. His call
That's
is
right.
dropping. I'm not sure. He doesn't have a very good connection.
Okay.
Jim, what's next for you? Have you started writing another book? Are you taking a break? What are you doing these days?
I just finished writing a novel titled The Jealous Kind. It's about a teenage love affair in 1952 in South Texas, Galveston, Houston, and I just love this book. I really love this book. It's the way I think it was back then, and I don't believe the 50s as a decade has been treated with much accuracy, to be honest. The best book, novel, I think, ever written about the 60s or 50s and late 40s was The Amboy Dukes. You ever read that? That's the way it really was. The Amboy Dukes. Rebel Without a Cause got it. Boy, did they get it. That was perfect. The television renditions of the 50s, it wasn't like that. At least not as I remember it.
Right.
It was the McCarthy era, the Korean Wars. Golly Moses. Nobody listened to Pat Boone, people. Pat Boone's a really nice gentleman, and he's a great singer, but that's not whom we listen to.
No, I don't think so. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Jim, do you still enjoy sitting down writing? Do you have lots of ideas and inspiration and stories that you want to tell still?
Well, it's the greatest life in the world. I'm just very fortunate, and the people who really deserve to be lauded, the guys who get up and write before they go to work, men and women who do that, and then come home and try to write when they're tired. Those are the heroes.
Whose books do you like to read, Jim?
I read all the time. I read a lot of historical and biographical books, but there are many great American novelists around, and people who are just superb writers. We're kind of in a period now, and the printed word is, maybe in danger. I get a little scared by it sometimes, that people have gone to sort of electronic shortcuts, I think. I don't know how many people read whole books anymore, but Ron Hansen's a fine writer. You ever read Ron Hansen?
No, I have not.
Probably the best.
Tobias
Wolff.
Really? I have an
Tobias
author for
Wolf.
You. Right out of
Annie
your
Proulx.
Area.
Pardon?
Yes.
Hello?
I have a great author who's right from New Orleans. A woman who just wrote a book. Her name is Toni McGee Causey. She wrote a book called The Saints of the Lost and Found, and it's a Southern Gothic tale that is extraordinary. And I would love to send you that book and to get your feedback on. You don't have to blurb it or anything. I just love to send it to you. So you would love it. It's so
well, it's very kind of you.
I'm
alive right now.
There you go. And there you go. Yes. And you're writing a book, so you don't have time to write. Let me ask you, Jim, what kind of music do you like to listen to?
Oh, all kinds. Blues, jazz, old rock and roll, any kind. I love any kind of music. I have some stringed instruments, and I have a lot of friends who play stringed instruments real well.
What do you play? What do you play?
Oh, I fool around with a guitar, and I've got a mandolin, but
How
I'm not
fun.
Any good at it. I'm what's that great song? There's 16,1400 guitar pickers in Nashville. Do you ever hear that song?
No.
Every Southern boy wants to go to Nashville with this guitar.
Well, there you go. Did you hope for that at one time?
Oh, yeah, I still do. Yeah.
Jim, you're so funny. I cannot thank you enough for spending this much time with Ro and I tonight. You have just been a delight, and please come back sometime. Please come back if you have the time. And I'm actually going to be your tech for your next show next week, so I'll be able to say hello again, although I'm not the host. James Lee Burke, you are absolutely magnificent and just a joy to speak to.
Well, you all have been very patient and kind. And by the way, I'm a friend of Bill W. I have been for over 38 years. So, and that fact is, it's given me a great life.
Well, you're fantastic. I'm so glad that you're here. Ro, you want to say your goodbyes before we hang up and leave Jim alone?
It was an honor to just be able to talk to you, ask you a few questions, and just listen to you. It was fantastic. Really made my night.
Thank you, Ro. You've been very kind, and I appreciate it. What part of New Orleans do you live in?
Actually, you just moved to Algiers Point
really?
Just over a year ago.
Yeah. Wow, right across the river, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll see you down there. We miss it. You always miss Louisiana. Louisiana's a poem. Dave Robichaux says Louisiana, New Orleans was a poem that went under the waves.
Wow. Well, I'm going to be there this year for the first time ever when I go to VoucherCon. So I'm excited to see it myself, to be honest with you. Ladies and gentlemen, James Lee Burke, magnificent. Thank you so much for being with me, Mr. Burke. And
well, call
I
me
just,
Jim. Yeah.
You got it,
thank
Jim.
You.
Thank you so much. Good night, sir. Have a great evening. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye. Good night.
Thank you, Rogue.
Okay, Ro, that was a dream come true for me. I don't know about you, but
yeah,
I'm on cloud
totally.
Nine right now. I'm on cloud nine. Friday, we're talking to Ann Voss Peterson, and I don't know, Ro, you're going to have to come back and do the show since I did most of the talking. I'm sorry that happened, but, you know, I get carried away with it. But I'll see you soon. You and I will talk. Thanks for being with us tonight, folks. I really appreciate it, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everybody. Night, Ro.
Bye-bye.